WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Derek Taylor, a publicity spokesman for the Beatles, died Sunday at the age of 65 of cancer. He was the group's press agent in the mid-60s and then returned in the late 60s as press agent for the Beatles company, AppleCorps. In between, Derek Taylor lived on the West Coast, where he did publicity for acts like the Byrds, Captain Beefheart, Judy Collins, and the Mamas and the Papas. Derek Taylor is the author of two memoirs, As Time Goes By and 50 Years Adrift, as well as an oral history of the Summer of Love, called It Was 20 Years Ago Today. Terry Gross spoke with Derek Taylor in 1987. She asked him to refresh our memories of what the Beatles were like in 1964, when he first started working for them.
Well, when I saw them first, it was at 63, they already had hits, and they were famous in Europe, and still fulfilling old contracts, playing cinemas and things. I was a newspaper man for then 15 years, and so stunned by the immediacy of these people's personalities. It wasn't so much the music, though that was fascinating. My wife and I saw that this was an exotic Liverpool adventure, and we were from Liverpool, living in Manchester. And I decided I would concentrate on covering their activities, and I was still supposed to be covering ballet in the theatre and low comedians and vaudeville, but of course it became almost obsessive covering the Beatles, because as I escalated my coverage for the Daily Express, so they were starting to get more and more famous. The Royal Show followed that year. They came to America in February 64. My newspaper did not send me to cover the trip. They used the American correspondent instead. It was then I decided I had to join them. If I was going to get on the trip, I had to be with them.
So they were already pretty famous.
Oh, yes.
By the time you joined.
Yes, I wasn't a publicist when I joined them. I was a journalist. So I didn't have to make them famous. But the job was to try and manipulate time, available time around these available Beatles, so that you'd got a line of people with no real rights, datebook magazine reporters, young people who'd clipped out coupons and said they were newspaper reporters who weren't, and then the Time magazine and the Saturday Evening Post over there. Murray the Cade had enough time. Hang on there, I'll deal with you in a moment, Murray. Ringo can talk there, because these people are after Ringo. And generally speaking, try and keep them in circulation, because I believe they should have been shared. They should be shared out. At the same time, you couldn't make them available all the time. And we tried to make the press conferences into an art form so that they were fun too.
You didn't stay on for very long the first time that you signed up as the Beatles press agent.
Job was intolerable. Intolerable.
Mm-hmm.
But it was...
So you kind of fell out of love with the Beatles?
I fell out of love with the job. The job was ridiculous.
Did the Beatles put impossible demands on you?
You know, the mental strain of staying up with these four buzzing people was exhausting. It was just too much. And I had four children.
You stayed in touch with the Beatles while you moved to the West Coast.
Yes.
And ended up promoting other rock groups and performers in California. But as you stayed in touch with the Beatles, did you change as they changed? And what I'm thinking here is, did you, for instance, start smoking and dropping acid at just about the same time?
No,
that
I was
did?
Always behind them, really. I was behind them. And one of the things they taught me first, perhaps more important than anything, and what everyone else got from them, was you should never be afraid not to know. I mean, they showed great courage in ignorance. If you asked them something they didn't know, they said, I don't know. George says in a book we did together, one of our strengths was we didn't know Hedda Hopper was important. If we'd known all those people were important, we'd never have had the gall to do the things we did. So in other words, they simplified my complicated life. They taught me, you know, the importance of a fresh kind of honesty, which I'd always held back. I was always impetuous and frank, but they taught me, they freed me from that. And then we had the cannabis, or marijuana, hash. That took us another level away from mundanity. Then they had LSD, and I had LSD, which they gave me.
They turned you on?
Yeah.
What was
David
that?
Crosby
what was...
gave me cannabis.
Uh-huh. What's that?
And then they, George and John gave Joan and me both LSD and RT in 67.
What was that day like? Did you know that you were taking LSD?
Yes, I knew.
LSD?
Well, I didn't know that I was taking LSD, quote-unquote, what it would mean. I didn't know I'd see the scarlet pillars and the Chartres Cathedral and all that stuff, and the barbed wire growing in the window of the limo trick. Right. But you don't see that. Nothing happens twice. But I knew we were in for the big one, sort of thing. And we were in the best of company. I knew enough about Leary to know that it was a set and setting situation. If you took it in the right mood and the right people, that would probably be all right.
What did you do that day, the first time you got high on acid and you were with the Beatles? Did you listen to records?
We sat at the piano and sang old songs until we cracked up at how badly I was playing. And we had a lot of fun.
Derek Taylor speaking with Terry Gross in 1987. We'll hear more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Back to Terry Gross's 1987 interview with Derek Taylor. He was the publicist for the Beatles in the 1960s.
You left the Beatles in 64. You returned to them in late 67, early 68 to be the head of publicity for Apple Records. You've described Apple as something that was set up to administer to the Beatles' desire to save the world.
Yes. Well, the idea was that that the promulgated idea was to set up physically a place where anyone could come. And if they weren't there, then I would be there with someone like me. And you'd say, I want to write a play, I want to make a film about a cup of tea. And we would say, here's the money, go and do it. And to make sure everyone knew, they went on the Johnny Carson show with Tallulah Bankhead and Joe Garagiola and announced this to an expectant nation who were delighted to hear this. I mean, practically everyone would like to do something. And they all arrived in England. All these people arrived in England saying, let's go, man. Where's this money?
And you were responsible, right, for all those people who showed up?
I was there every day, and I was working, sort of office hours, 9 to 5. So were they at the beginning. So were the Beatles. But they soon tired of this adventure.
Who were some of the more lunatic people that showed up at your door?
Well, I mean, I don't want to say that the Hell's Angels were lunatics, but these people could be difficult and eccentric. They were not formal, conventional folk. And George dropped a memo in one day, which it's been one of the books accurately quoted. And it said, while in San Francisco, I met some very nice fellows who were in the Hell's Angels, and I asked them over, when they come, please tell the staff not to be frightened and treat them well. I mean, this is the heavy chapter, and they did indeed arrive with their bikes and with Ken Kesey and with the people they call their old ladies, the women.
So what'd you do?
Put them up, took them in. I mean, this is sort of, we got to work about 9:30. I lived in out of town, came in on the train, got in a taxi, got to work, and there's all the Hell's Angels in the lobby. Bikes sort of half in and out of this very, very smart house in Savile Row in the West End. Kesey was there demanding typewriters and access to ribbons and paper. I got to, he's going to cover this thing and do his readings every morning. And we had just accommodated them. I was very, very adroit then. We'd full of acid and full of the belief that if you said it, you could do it. If you wished it, you could have it.
Philip Norman, in his book about the Beatles' shout, quotes you as saying, in reference to the pressure at Apple, that whatever the motivation was, the effect was slavery, whatever the Beatles asked had to be done.
Yes, well, that's pretty true.
What kinds of things were asked that you felt?
Well, acorns in April. Acorns in April, anyone would know there are no acorns left by April. The squirrels have had them, they've decayed, acorns fall off the trees in the northern hemisphere in the fall, the autumn. By April, they've all gone. So when John and Yoko wanted April, I mean, this is just an example, isn't it? They called from Honeymoon to say, Derek, yes, can you get us, 300 acorns, that's two for each of 150 world leaders. We're going to mail them off in little boxes on little sort of pads of silk or cotton wool with a message for peace, tell them to grow two trees on the banks of the Jordan. And so we'll be in tomorrow afternoon. So, I mean, you've got to get the acorns, not because you're frightened of them, but because this is a demand being made by reasonable people behaving unreasonably. Have I made sense of this? These are people who have had the idea in a climate of ideas come true, dreams come true. And what we should have said was, right then, there are no acorns. I would have to think of something else. We'll do it when you get back. In other words, we should have looked on it with sobriety. Instead of that, it was, right, now how can we do it? and fail. And it's much better to fail right at the beginning and say, it can't be done, John. It's not sensible.
Could you tell that the Beatles were going to break apart?
I was never that able to face up to those sort of things. No. Even when it was over, I was giving interviews on the Hoof, live satellite kind of interviews that afternoon, saying, well, it won't be for long. Because there had been difficulties. I mean, George left the Let It Be sessions, and I think John had left before. Hindsight tells us he had. And there'd been more to keep them together than to break them apart. But indeed, they did break up, as we know. And it was probably very healthy that they did, though I would rather they'd broken up in a nicer way.
Derek Taylor spoke with Terry Gross in 1987. He died Sunday.